What's up, everybody? Welcome to this week's episode of Hidden Forces with me, Dimitri Kafinas. Today, I speak with Daniel Pink, the author of numerous highly acclaimed and best-selling books, including his latest, When: The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. In addition to his writing career, Pink was also the host and co-executive producer of Crowd Control, a television series about human behavior. He also appears frequently on NPR's Hidden Brain, the PBS NewsHour, and other TV and radio networks. He's been a contributing editor at Fast Company and Wired, as well as a business columnist for the Sunday Telegraph. Pink's TED Talk on the Science of Motivation is one of the 10 most watched TED Talks of all time, with more than 19 million views. And his RSA animated video about the ideas in his book Drive has collected more than 14 million. Daniel, welcome to Hidden Forces.
Dimitri, thanks for having me.
That was well synced.
Indeed.
That was synchronous. See, I try to put some rhythm. Actually, I did this before I read your book. I have a rhythmic style to my intro, and we add the music afterwards. You couldn't hear the music now.
Okay.
But we're going to talk about rhythm and syncing and time and the way that we experience time and what times are optimal. Chronobiology.
Yes, sir.
Which is what your book When is about.
Well, it's partly about chronobiology. It's really about the whole science of timing, part of which is chronobiology. Chronobiology is basically the study in biology of our daily rhythms. But there's research in timing that crosses many, many, many disciplines. Economics, microbiology, anthropology, cognitive science. And that's, I think, what's interesting about it. You got all these people in different fields asking pretty much similar questions.
So is chronobiology something akin to circadian rhythms?
Sure, yeah. I mean, circadian rhythms, unpack the word chrono, time, biology, study of life. It's basically the study of life's rhythms, the circadian rhythms being at the red-hot center of all of that, exactly as you say.
Well, as I started reading the book and got deeper into it, I found it completely true of my own life, completely true. And I actually began to implement the weekend that I was reading your book, your insights about when, because I was already doing it sort of in a way. I was aware of it, but I wasn't doing it consciously and really taking advantage of it. This idea of front-loading my day with the sort of cognitive heavy tasks.
Yeah.
In that muddle middle between 2 and 4, if I'm, a lark, but basically it depends on who I am, there's a middle of the day where I just really start to struggle through. That's where I should do mundane tasks like email, put on some heavy metal or something, just blast through. I love your thing about the cappuccino. I mean, the espresso, I did that too. And we'll get into all of this. And then the creative aspect, I love that because I record these shows in the afternoon exactly for that reason,
right?
Though I didn't know it.
That's great to hear. I endorse everything you say except for the heavy metal part.
Oh, you don't like heavy metal?
It's all right.
It can help you get through difficult times.
Okay.
In your mental period. So let's start off with...
I'll have to put Iron Maiden on my Spotify list.
Now after this. Yeah. Or Metallica.
Metallica, sure. That was a little... Metallica is more of a cliche heavy metal.
Yeah, I think you're correct about that.
Is a little bit...
I know.
Yeah.
I know. So tell me a little bit about yourself. How did you get... were you born in a sort of behavioral enthusiast? Was this from day one, Daniel Pink was interested in what motivates human beings?
A little bit, but more than anything else, I think I was more interested in finding out stuff. So, you know, I grew up in Central Ohio. Probably one of the formative experiences of my life growing up in Central Ohio was the availability of public libraries. In the town that I lived in, had a terrific public library. In the bigger city of Columbus, there was a huge downtown public library. I spent a lot of time in libraries when I was a kid, and I, you know, read a lot and just went off on my own to try to find out stuff. And it turned out that's what I ended up doing for a living.
How old were you when you were going to libraries?
Oh, this is back in the days when parents would let their little kids, you know, walk 15 minutes, 13 blocks away from home. So, you know, 7 or 8, 9, 10.
Other kids were loitering on the street or playing soccer.
I was
and
doing
you were
both.
Going to the library.
Well, we weren't playing soccer in Central Ohio in the 1970s. We were playing touch football because soccer was more of like a European thing.
Right, East Coast thing.
Or European, even further beyond the East Coast. No, so I did both. I mean, I played touch football on the street. I played baseball as a kid. I played pickup basketball as a kid. But I also, perhaps unlike some of my friends, spent a lot of time in libraries.
It's insane to me how many nerds we have on this show. People that literally say this same story when they're young.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We had Josh Wolf talking about... Actually, one of our guests talked about having information anxiety. Another one, from a young age, he had to learn everything, and if he didn't, freaked him out. Another guy said he suffered from premature intellectual closure.
I don't even know what that means.
I know. I had to unpack it.
Yeah.
But
I don't know if I want to unpack that one.
It basically meant that he came to a premature understanding of the nature of the universe before he actually knew what he was talking about. And subsequently became quite a philosophical, I think, genius in many ways. All right, so you went off on your own. You went to libraries. Were you introduced to libraries by your mother or your father? And at first, did you go to like for readings?
Yeah, well, no. Well, I don't know if I really went to any readings, but my parents, especially my mother, was a big reader. She took us to libraries, and that just became a thing that we did. But also, the town that I grew up in Central Ohio, I could walk to a lovely public library. It was like a 15-minute walk away from my house. And as I was saying before, Dimitri, those are back in the days when parents were totally fine, you know, having their 9-year-old take a 15-minute walk by themselves somewhere.
I'm sensing a theme of another book. Is this?
No, not at all. That book's been written a gazillion times.
Oh, have you already written?
I haven't. I haven't written it.
The importance of autonomy and sort of growth. Or
well,
whatever.
I wrote. That's part of what Drive is about. Right. It's about, you know, how autonomy and self-direction. It's a big part of what motivates people.
Do you remember what books were some of the first that you encountered and maybe had a real love affair with? I mean, to.
Sure. I mean, I remember one in particular that I think ended up having a bigger effect on my future than I would have expected at the moment. And it's a book by a guy named Studs Terkel. Studs Terkel was a radio host in Chicago. My parents were both Chicagoans, even though I grew up in Ohio. And in the early 1970s, he wrote a book called Division Street, which is about a street in Chicago, Division Street. And what Studs Terkel did is Studs Terkel was an oral historian, and what he would do is he would just interview people, regular folks, not famous folks, about their lives. So he did a book about Division Street. My parents, being Chicagoans transplanted to Central Ohio, read that book. All right. So my mother ended up picking up one of Terkel's next books, and that book was a book called Working. Famous, legendary book now, and it was a book that interviewed people about their jobs. Big, thick book with a white cover, blue letters, Working. And Terkel would interview people from all different kinds of professions. And my mother brought home that book one day from the library. I saw it lying around. I'm in Central Ohio in the 1970s, so I'm bored out of my mind. So I pick up the book. And I started reading about the baseball player, because I was way into baseball. But then I stuck around for the taxi driver. What's his life like? The nurse, what was her life like? The school teacher, and all these other stories about work. And I think that I don't know if that was the moment that began this lifelong fascination, but I've had this long fascination with work. What do people do all day? What's it like? Because if you think about it, we spend half of our waking hours, sometimes more, at work. So work becomes this way to study the human condition in all of its dimensions. Why do people do what they do? How do they get along? What are the causes of conflict? How do they get stuff done? What are the obstacles in the way of getting stuff done? Why do people fight? Why do some people succeed and other people don't? And so I think if there is a book that launched this fascination, it was that book, you know, which is a freaking long time ago.
That's fascinating. Well, let's get to this book, because with that one, you're really touching on Drive. A lot of what's in Drive has to do with what motivates people, why people do what they
sure,
do.
Sure, sure, sure.
And you've written a number of books. The first one that I think made you most famous, that you're most famous for, is Why Right Brainers. Well, what's it called?
It's called A Whole New Mind.
A Whole New Mind.
Yeah, about why right brainers will rule the future. But I wrote another book before that called Free Agent Nation, about the rise of people working for themselves. That was, I guess, in some vague sense, inspired by Studs Terkel, because to write that book, I went around the country interviewing people who had left traditional jobs to go out and work for themselves. Why did they do it? What was it like? What were the struggles? And so that book, I think, was inspired a little bit by my experience.
Well, that's kind of the world we're living in now, right? I mean, you wrote that book when, in the early 2000s?
Yeah, exactly. The book came out in 2001. So I think it was a little ahead of the voters on that one.
Yeah, very ahead of it. Very prescient. I mean, look at that. You could have gone long WeWork, although some people are going short it.
Oh, I would totally. Well, I can say that. I'm not going to give investment advice.
Okay.
I don't know. Well, WeWork is actually really, really interesting. It's really, really interesting as a phenomenon. I've been to a lot of WeWork spaces. I think they're really fascinating.
You spend a lot of time looking at financial investments and thinking about...
No.
No?
No, but that doesn't stop me from opining about it.
But that's
them.
Interesting. Yeah. No, but that's interesting you have a view on that.
Yeah.
How do you get your information when it comes to, to financial markets?
Reading widely across a number of different sources. I mean, I think what WeWork is actually really, really interesting, but what WeWork is doing is essentially subletting space. Mm. I mean, that's basically what it does. It rents buildings, and then it subleases the
slightly space. Equips them, yeah.
So, right, and maybe adds value there, but it's basically subletting space. And so I don't think that's necessarily a bad business. I'm not sure it's like it's worth a multi-gazillion dollars that it is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there are some other businesses that have been able to benefit from the giant tsunami of cheap credit, and that's a dangerous proposition always. How did you get to writing this book when? I mean, was there a moment when it hit you, or is it just one of those things with writing these types of books? This is now your sixth, correct? there's an accumulation, a drip, drip, drip from all the other work you do, and you kind of eventually sort of almost know where you're going with it?
Oh, I have no idea where I'm going with things. So that explanation doesn't work. It's actually in some ways simpler and less interesting than that. I wrote this book basically because I was frustrated, because I was making all kinds of timing decisions in my own life. I was making them in a haphazard way, and that was frustrating. I didn't want to make these decisions in such a sloppy way. And so I started looking around for guidance, truly, in the hopes that I could read a book that would give me some guidance, and it didn't exist. And that really surprised me. And then I started looking at the research, because I'd done a lot of work looking at social science research, and what I found in the research just blew me away right from the start. So this book I truly wrote inspired entirely by the question, how does timing affect us? How does the time of day affect us? How do beginnings affect us? How do midpoints affect us? How do endings affect us? I didn't have, you know, a theory of the case going into this book. I really just had a series of questions. And because ultimately, at the very, very heart of it, this is a book I wanted to read. So, unfortunately, in order to read it, I had to write it.
Well, that's a sign of a great entrepreneur in general. If you want a product, you make it. So,
yeah, right. That's a good point. I hadn't thought about it that way.
Yeah, for sure. If you could put it into one question, what was it? It was, how can I structure my life better? How can I optimize the timing of my life?
How can I make better decisions about when to do things?
Oh, interesting. Okay. So what's the verdict?
The verdict is that there are all kinds of ways. There isn't a single answer to that question. But the ultimate answer is that we think that timing is an art. We make our decisions based on intuition and guesswork. That's the wrong way to do it. Timing is really a science, and we can make those decisions based on evidence, facts, and science.
Well, one of the concluding sentences in your book, I think it's a concluding sentence because I actually had a quote from Miles Davis at the top of my rundown, but I had to replace it, so it must have been at the very end. You wrote, I used to believe that timing was everything. Now I believe that everything is timing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Explain that a little bit deeper. Help use that as a way to get us deeper into sort of what your findings were here.
Well, what I discovered was this, that we often don't take a multidimensional look at our lives. So, for instance, we're very focused in our day-to-day work, especially at work. We're very focused on our day-to-day work with what we do. Okay, so people are very intentional about that. They have a to-do list, right? That's intentionality about what they're doing. We're fairly intentional about who we do stuff with because companies have HR departments, right? But we don't take these questions of when we do things seriously enough. We think of them as second or third order questions, or we sort of sit all the when questions over at the kids' table and don't let them sit at the grown-ups' table. And what I've discovered is that those questions of when have a material effect on our lives. They shape our day-to-day experience. They shape our performance. They shape our well-being. They shape how we interact with others. And so instead of having when be on the periphery, I think what I found is that timing actually operates at the center. And I don't think it's more important than what we do or how we do it or who we do it with, but I think it's as important. Actually, I don't think there's any question about that. I think it's as important because at some level, we are temporal creatures. We have not a biological clock. We have biological clocks in every cell in our body. We're timepieces moving around here. We also operate in time, right? You know, yesterday was the past. Tomorrow is the future. This moment when I'm speaking this sentence is the present. And so we're temporal creatures living in a temporal landscape. And we know that these questions of timing have a material effect on how we perform and how we feel. And so when I say that everything is timing, it's like it's threaded through everything that we do.
It's interesting hearing you talk. It made me think of something today that I did and your book came to my mind. I had to do some really dumb work. And I had to, unfortunately, unfortunately, there's a lot of work like that. And I didn't want to have to do it in the morning because I had read your book and I took that to heart. And yet there were external factors that were forcing me to have to do it early.
Right.
And I think that makes me think about this thing, which is kind of what you're saying, if I understand it correctly, and please correct me if I'm mistaken or wherever I'm mistaken, but there is a sort of when we have to do things in terms of when they have to get done because of external factors, and there's a tension between that and when we have to do things based on the internal biology.
Yeah, good point.
Right?
Yeah.
Is that sort of...
Totally.
And
totally.
Sort of structuring your life accordingly and making those trade-offs.
Yeah, sometimes they're in conflict and sometimes we can ride them. And so, but I think that the ultimate question is exactly as you put it, which is just simply being aware of those in the first place. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what we know about the hidden pattern of the day is that, you know, we move through the day in these three stages, peak, trough, recovery. Most of us move through in that order. And people who are owls, much more complicated, they often go recovery, trough, peak. They are at their analytic peak much later in the day. But for you, it sounds like you're more of a lark than
Okay,
so you're more of an early morning person. So you move through the day like this. Peak, generally early in the day, trough, middle of the day, recovery, later in the day.
100%.
And what we know about this is that, one, and this is extremely important, our cognitive abilities don't stay the same throughout the day. They change. Two, the changes can be significant. All right, that's the other thing. The difference between the daily high point and the daily low point can be monumental. And third, what we do when we do stuff depends on what we're doing. So for you, you should be doing, and I think we're similar in that case because I'm more of a lark than an owl. I'm not a heavy lark, but I'm larky. We should be doing our analytic work in the morning.
What's analytic work?
Analytic work is work that requires vigilance. This is the key word in all the research, vigilance. What does vigilance mean? Vigilance means you can bat away distractions, all right? And that makes it a good time for doing lockdown, heads-down kind of work, writing a report, analyzing data, that kind of thing.
Cognitive-heavy tasks.
Yeah, that certain kind of cognitive skill, though, because our cognitive
abilities. Decision-making.
Yeah, things that require focus rather than a more expansive view. And so you're exactly right, Dimitri, is that that's when we should be doing that kind of work. Now, we all operate in the real world. And as you say, there are external pressures here, too. And the external pressures say, we don't want you to do that kind of work now. We want you to do something else. And I think there is a kind of battle there. But I think one of the keys is recognizing that there is that battle, all right, rather than letting these external forces always take over. And this is one of those things where if you look at schedules at work, most schedules at work for people don't take this into account. Most bosses don't take this stuff into account. And what we know is that time of day explains about 20% of the variance in how people perform on these workplace tasks. It's a big deal. And so as we're operating on this, we have to recognize those external forces might not always be in sync with our internal forces. And, you know, either bat away those external forces or succumb to them in as cost-free a way as we possibly can.
So you have a ton of examples, including, I think, the most compelling, which is, or the most alarming, which has to do with physicians and outcomes. For example, colonoscopies that happen in the afternoon versus the morning, or surgeries that happen in the morning versus the afternoon. But this Twin Peaks phenomenon is something that happens at various degrees of scale. It isn't just an internal clock, but we also see it in the way that people go through their entire lives. There's a sort of peaking when you're younger, then there's a middle sort of area, and then there is life begins to get better as you get older.
Which
goes against the traditional idea that once you hit your sort of midlife crisis, it's all done.
Yeah, midlife crisis is totally bogus. Totally bogus idea. It's one of the most bogus ideas in our modern conceptions of human beings.
Why is that?
There's no evidence for it. It was catapulted into our consciousness in 1965 by a fellow named Elliot Jacques, who was a French-Canadian psychoanalyst. He just asserted it. There's no evidence of it, and anybody who's looked for it hasn't found it. What they do find is exactly as you're saying, that in midlife we have a dip, that there's a U-shaped curve of well-being. And so people are generally, you know, reasonably happy in their 20s and 30s. They begin to decline a little bit in their 40s, in their 50s.
Is any of that hormonal?
It's a good question. I don't know.
I think, you know, just to drive home your point about the second peak, I've seen that in people that are in their 60s and 70s, friends who express a lot of happiness and joy, in fact, that they've, a lot of the things that gave them angst when they were younger, they no longer have.
Well, and that's what happens. People come out of that, they hit that bottom peak, they hit that bottom point, but it's not a crisis, it's just a dip in their 50s. And then, you know, around the mid to late 50s, start coming out of it, and the rest of their life is pretty much on an upswing. And so you do have, and this is counterintuitive to people, because we think that older age is this very sad time in life, and the evidence shows it's actually not.
Right.
It really isn't. The level of well-being in people, not every single person, obviously, but the overall population level of well-being in people in their 60s and 70s is remarkably high.
Yeah, I think.
And part of that, I think, is because they're focused on the things that we know actually matter. They have shed a lot of the things that obsess us when we're younger, status, money, and all that kind of stuff. And what we know, again, there's a famous study called the Grant Study of, you have to take it with a grain of salt because it studied only men, only white men from Harvard, but that followed them from the 1930s or so, all the way later in their life to see who flourished and who didn't. And it basically came down to this. The people who flourished were people who had meaningful relationships.
Mm.
Period.
Mm.
That's it.
Mm. I want to get into that with you towards the end when we get into group timing.
Yeah.
Because there's actually a lot of interesting stuff that you did there that relates to a show that we recently did as well. But I want to bring it back to vigilance, because you made a big point of that in the book. You talked about, I think you referred to them as sentries guarding the castle. What would you?
Yeah, basically, that's what it means to be vigilant.
So I was trying to understand, though, I guess the reason I bring that up is I was confused whether that was a metaphor, strictly, or if it was also a hint about the origins of this paradigm that we have, right? In other words, what accounts for it, do you think? What are some of the compelling theories about what accounts for this heightened vigilance in the morning hours and this more creative, mood-enhancing period as we head towards bed?
It's a great question. I don't think we know the answer. And so this idea of centuries, that is, in the morning, or in the peak, because not everybody has their peak in the morning, but in the peak, we basically have these sentries, these guards who are protecting us from distraction. So it's purely metaphorical, I think. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's more literal than I know. But why that's happening, I don't think we know fully. Some of it is something as simple as fatigue, okay? But beyond that, I don't think we know.
Wasn't that when you would do most of your work if you were sort of a nomadic hunter? It'd be in the morning, and at night you're sort of resting?
Could be. But I'll see your speculation and raise it. That is, I think there's an evolutionary explanation. I don't know if it's right, but there's an evolutionary explanation for a lot of these things. So, for instance, take that, to your point, Dimitri, take that midday dip, the trough early in the afternoon. Why did that occur? Why is that? We don't know, okay? What we have in this thing, in a lot of this research, is a lot of correlation that is rock solid correlation, but we don't know fully causation. Those are two very different things, of course. And so when we have that midday dip, the evolutionary explanation of it, I think, is pretty simple. We go back to those nomadic tribes, all right? Human beings descend. We used to live in trees. We descend from the trees. We're walking around on the savanna, right, in these nomadic tribes, all right? The sun is at its highest in the middle of the day, all right? And you're totally exposed. So the people who had a propensity to get sleepy then went under a tree, one of the few trees around, and had a little nap. The other people who were
long
more,
nap.
But the people who are more awake are baking in the sun and dying or getting eaten by saber-toothed tigers. And so those people didn't pass their genes to the next generation. The people who got sleepy that time of day did, and that could be an evolutionary explanation for why we have that midday dip. At the same time, if you look at the changes in chronobiology over time, what you see is little kids are very larky, but there's a big change in chronobiology when we get to our mid-teens. Mid-teens to mid-20s, there's a big move.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
To lateness.
We all had that.
Right, because we're all human beings. So why is that? So there is a theory that is also evolutionary, that what you wanted to protect the nomadic at night, the nomadic people, were the youngest, fittest people, mostly men, in the same way that every culture has sent young men to fight in wars, because they're the ones who are most risk-prone and the physically strongest. And so what happened was that the men that evolution selected for men, especially, who could...
Do men have a propensity to stay up later than women?
Men are owlier than women, not by massive amounts, by some. There's some interesting implications of that. And so evolution selected for men who could stay up later. They were more highly prized, and they passed their genes on to the next generation.
We men are party animals. So this
there's something, you know what? I mean, there's something to be said for that. Women are larkier than men. Men are owlier than women. What you also see is that once we get past this period of intense owliness, in general, there's a move toward greater larkiness over the course of our lives. But women return to larkiness faster than men and from a lower point. So what you see very frequently is that in heterosexual couples, men and women of the same age often have incompatible sleeping patterns, where the man is owlier on average than the woman. And so the man is going to sleep later than the woman. Mm-hmm. And you see this, if you just look at the charts of basically the chronotypes by age, you see that men and women of the same age often have incompatible sleeping patterns.
Is this why girls totally do better in school? I mean, I remember girls doing better in school. Is this part of the explanation that they have an easier time functioning in the morning? I always remember the girls, on average, had their notes, they had their pencils, they were just looked fresher, and the guys were a mess. That's how I remember school.
It's a great point. It could be. I think there are a lot of other factors.
I mean, culturally, maybe they were just more put together. But
I think you make a very, very good point. I think part of it also is the nature of school as we think of it today, is that schools are very much about kind of compliance and order, and boys want to run around and do things, and so... That's not prized.
Do things.
Yeah, I mean, they want to run around. They don't want to sit still. Yeah. School, in a traditional sense, is all about sitting still.
Sure, yeah.
Girls are better at that than boys. You know, boys also, especially young men, this is why we send them to war. Young, you know, teenagers to mid-20s, there's a lot of evidence showing that their frontal cortex is not fully formed until, you know, into their 20s, which is why they make all kinds of stupid, risky, bad decisions as all of us did during that time of our lives.
Are men or are boys more prone to be diagnosed with ADHD than women?
I don't know.
Or girls?
I don't know.
Would also be interesting.
I would guess yes,
at.
But I don't know.
That's interesting. So this also makes a case for the siesta, right? Which is something that has been around in many European countries and other, I suppose other countries as well for a long time. It's something that we've gotten rid of. I wonder also to what extent that accounts for some of the better health outcomes in some of these Mediterranean economies, which do that, right? Because we've always kind of traditionally looked at food. So this kind of just hammers home the point that there has been just generally speaking, I know from a sleep science standpoint, now this is a much sort of broader point about timing, but there's been a neglect of this as a causal factor for all sorts of things, as a variable for all sorts of things. And we've been looking at groups and maybe not properly taking this into account. You talked about the varying chronobiologies, larks. What was the other one?
Owls on the other side.
Well, owls, larks.
And in the middle, I just call them third birds.
Yeah, anyway, basically there is this spectrum of chronobiology. What do we know about the differences between different chronotypes? I think you've said, if I'm not mistaken, in your book, owls tend to be more creative, right? Is that correct?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. So there's some interesting personality differences among larks and owls. Larks tend to be conscientious, extroverted. Owls tend to be less so, but owls tend to test higher on intelligence tests. Owls often test higher on creative tests of creativity. Owls often are more prone to addiction, depression, all kinds of things. So owls are much more of the outlier. And what we have is we've got 15% of us are larks, about 20% of us are owls. Most of us are in the middle. Most of us are a little bit of both. But owls, also there's some owls that are just absurdly owly. I mean, just so late night. That's just the nature of who they are. So owls are much more complicated. And what's worse is that the world, particularly the corporate world, is built in a way that's basically trying to destroy owls.
Right. Well, that's something that we should get into as well, which is basically how do we, and I'd like to do that as we get towards the end, which is what lessons can we take from these and reasonably apply them to the world in a way that we could dramatically improve health outcomes and also productivity. But before we do that, and this kind of gets into this, which is exercise, because you also make some interesting insights about how this applies to our physiological regime, our exercise regimen. What have you found in terms of how timing informs the way in which we should be physically active? And when we should be physically active?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of when in the day we should exercise, it really depends on your goals. I think it lays out fairly neatly. So you're better off exercising in the morning. This is really for the 80% of us who are not owls. Owls should not be exercising 6 o'clock in the morning because they probably went to sleep 3 hours ago. Mm-hmm. Not a good idea. But for the 80% of us, here's what we know. Morning exercise is good for some things. Afternoon exercise is good for other things. It really depends on your goals. So morning exercise is better if you want to form a habit. Seems to be slightly better for habit formation, probably because if you exercise late in the day, early in the evening, you're more likely to get interrupted than you are if you exercise at 7 in the morning. Morning exercise seems to be better for weight loss, although exercise, we're learning, isn't a massive force in weight loss, not nearly as much as we thought. And morning exercise is good because exercise gives us a significant mood boost. It's fairly enduring. And so if you exercise later in the day, you sleep away some of that mood boost. Afternoon exercise is better for other things. It's better for avoiding injury because our body temperature is higher. We're literally more warmed
up. Totally makes sense.
Afternoon exercise is better for people enjoy it more. People find it less effortful. That's why I do it. Mm. Like, I find morning exercise excruciating. Mm. And when I exercise late in the afternoon or in the early evening, I actually kind of enjoy it. And then afternoon, early evening exercise is definitely better for performance. Our hand-eye coordination is better. Our lung function
afternoon.
Is higher. Yeah, afternoon, early evening. Our lung function is higher, our speed is greater
for sure.
At the time of day.
That's also an area where I've seen changes in my behavior. When I was younger, I would sleep. I mean, in college, there were days where I slept until 4 p.m. no joke, and that was like totally normal.
Yeah.
And now I'm pretty much up by 7 or 6:30 or so. And the same thing with my exercise. I used to exercise always in the evening or in the late afternoon, and now I always exercise in the morning. Well, correction, I used to always exercise in the morning when I had less control over my schedule. But one of the things that I've experimented doing now, and then I sort of kept doing it as a matter of habit because I thought, I have two choices, afternoon or morning. But I've actually changed that around a little bit, and this is what I wanted to ask you, because in your book, you separate exercise and you separate these cognitive tasks into two different domains, and you analyze them separately. But we exercise and think, right? So we do both of these things. I actually exercise around 2 p.m. And I find that it gives me, it breaks up the day for me.
Interesting.
And I'm able to do that. Now, I don't sleep. I wish I could sleep in the middle of the day, but I just can't seem to do it. I would love to do it. Yeah. I have the time. Yeah. And you have a great tip about sleeping like about 15 minutes and taking an espresso right before you go to bed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on your point about exercising, here's the thing. I mean, I think you make another really good point, Dimitri, which is that the most important thing that we have to do is we have to observe our own behavior better. We don't do a very good job of watching how we feel, how we do at different times of day. So if 2 o'clock exercise works for you, go for it. And I think that's one of the lessons of the book, is that we need to pay attention to these patterns over the course of a day, over the course of a lifetime, and listen and watch what we're doing and how we're doing. As for the naps, naps are pretty good for us, actually. The surprising thing is that the best naps, the most effective naps, are extremely short, between 10 and 20 minutes long, much shorter than I would have expected. If we nap longer than that, we begin to accumulate what's called sleep inertia, which is that groggy, boggy feeling you get when you wake up from a nap that's too long. And so 10 to 20 minutes gives you that benefit of a nap, the restoration of a nap without the sleep inertia.
Right. Then you're ready to party into the evening again if you get a couple hours sleep. That's, again, summertime when you're younger.
Sure.
All right. So before we move to some of the other things that I do want to get into, I want to, though, ask you, in your book, you've got a chart and you actually lay out some very specific tasks, and I think this will help the audience think about how this applies in very specific cases. You have, for example, analytical tasks early morning. Mm-hmm. This, again, let's just use the classic case of the lark, mm-hmm. quote, lark person.
Or even people in the middle. The
right,
third
okay.
Yeah.
Analytical tasks in the morning, we got into that. Insight tasks, we got into that late afternoon, early evening. Making an impression, this is very interesting, making a decision, both of these you put in the morning and early morning. You also talked, I think, about conflict or challenging or difficult conversation or something, that should happen in the morning, or is it, maybe that was just me thinking about it, because I actually have a very difficult conversation that I have to have with someone, and I scheduled it specifically because of your book at 11 a.m. tomorrow.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Thanks. Well, I feel like I've got carnivology on my side. So we talked about insight and analytic tasks. What about making an impression, for example? Let's talk about that one.
Sure.
What does that mean?
Sure. Well, I mean, let's think about it from the perspective of the other person, not you. So you're trying to make an impression, all right? You're trying to get somebody to do something. Let's say it's a job interview. You're trying to get them to hire you, or you're selling something. You want them to buy your product. One of the things we know about decision making is that when people come into decisions, they often have a default decision in their back pocket. And the default decision in many, many cases is no. You come in for a job interview, we don't want to hire you. You go to sell something, we don't want to buy it. You ask your boss for a raise, no. Okay? So the default decision is usually no. So the question then becomes, when are people likely to overcome the default? And what we know from the research and some interesting studies of judicial decision making and other kinds of things is people in general are more likely to overcome the default early in the day and immediately after breaks. And so what we're talking about here is exactly what you're talking about with your 11 o'clock meeting. They want to put the science on your side. It doesn't lock it down, all right? This is very important to understand. So let's say that I want to make an impression and get the job, or I want to ask my boss for a raise. Let's say I want to ask my boss for a raise. My boss has a default decision, no, all right? How can I get her to overcome the default? Let's say I'm selling something, that's a better example. I'm selling something, all right? My prospect is gonna say no, all right? Let's say I have a 9% chance of getting a yes, all right? If I pick the right time, maybe I can dial up that 9% to 13%, okay? There's still an 87% chance I'm gonna get a no, mm-hmm. but I will take that jump from 9% to 13% if I'm doing it a lot. Because over time, that's going to pay mm-hmm. dividends. And that's what we're talking about. Same thing is true with your 11 o'clock meeting. Difficult conversations are, by their very definition, difficult. It's probably going to be a difficult conversation. However, picking the right time gives you some odds of making it less difficult. And if you have these conversations, these types of conversations over and over again, eventually that's going to work in your favor.
Although if the person's an owl, maybe they're grumpy and they're
right.
pissed off and they're not happy they're there.
Right.
I just thought of that now. I should have thought of that earlier. All right, so let's talk about breaks. You refer to them as detachment. I find this also really rings true for me. And you talk also not just about breaks in terms of time, but you also talk about what you do in those breaks, which means don't work, don't look or reflect on the things that you were doing. And also, if you can get out and see nature, again, something I've totally experienced.
Yeah.
Ever since I started this company for the last year or so, I've had to work through weekends every single week without break. And the way that I've managed to do that pretty much is I go away on the weekend and I work from a place where I see the water. And I never thought really about that from a scientific standpoint. Talk to me about what you refer to as psychological and physical detachment.
Yeah, it's not very complicated. It basically means unplugging. What we have is this notion is that the way to get more done is to power through. Go, 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 go. We think that that's the way to get achieve more. We also have this notion that somehow it's morally virtuous to do that. And it's wrong. What the science tells us is that detachment is a performance enhancer. And this is something where I have made mistakes myself. I used to be one of those people who very rarely took a break because I believed if I power through, I'll get more done. And also I'll feel better about myself because it's the moral virtue of powering through. Wrong. I had this notion that amateurs took breaks, professionals don't. It's 100% the opposite. Professionals take breaks. Amateurs are the ones who don't take
breaks. That's really interesting. I've heard people say that before with respect to sleep.
There's no question
about
it.
That's so interesting. I never
had
that idea.
Yeah, but I think the science of breaks is where the science of sleep was 15 years ago.
That's so interesting.
That 15 years ago, you were a hero if you pulled an all-nighter. Now we know enough. We say you're an idiot if you pull an all-nighter. Now we say, oh, you're heroic. You never take a break. I think that it's following the same trajectory, that in a few years we'll say, look at that amateur. He never takes a break.
So interesting. The science of beginnings, that's something else you talk about. I really like this. And this kind of brings us back to something else, which I failed to mention, which is that this is not contingent on having an external timekeeping, some way to keep time. This is something that in studies, people that have been deprived of clocks actually still exhibit the same general sort of twin peak phenomenon. Right?
Yeah. It's at different times if they're removed from
right. Well,
light,
if they're removed for a long period of time, but they still tend to sort of have a sense of middle, have a sense of beginning.
Yeah.
Tell me about the importance of beginnings. You talk about the people at the age of 29, 39, 49. Maybe that's not beginning. That's actually probably
that's
middle.
Endings,
that's endings. But then let's talk about both of them. Let's talk about this importance of markers. This is completely artificial.
Totally.
Just like decades. These are artificial markers, centuries. All this is artificial.
Totally.
Talk to me about how this influences people and how people motivate themselves and are motivated by these artificial markers of time and space.
Yeah, so what you're talking about in some ways is what social psychologists call temporal landmarks. And so we can see a big effect on those with beginnings. So there's certain days of the year that stand out as landmarks in time the way that physical landmarks stand out in space. So when we're driving along or we're moving along through space, we see a physical landmark. What does it do? We slow down, we pay attention. Temporal landmarks operate very similarly, but there's a certain kind of temporal landmark that also triggers this very peculiar form of mental accounting, where we look at that temporal landmark and say, oh, okay, I'm going to open up a fresh ledger on this day in the same way a business would open up a fresh ledger on a new year, on a new quarter. And this is what these researchers, Heng-Chen Dai, Katie Milkman, and Jason Rees call the fresh start effect. There are certain dates that are these temporal landmarks where we stop, we slow down, and we open up a fresh ledger on ourselves. The most obvious one of those is New Year's Day. Mm. That's why we have New Year's resolutions. And to me, we've gotten the story of New Year's resolutions pretty much wrong. We talk about, oh, New Year's resolutions are ridiculous. You know, half of them are never kept. To me, I'm like, does that mean half of them are kept? That's freaking unbelievable. Given how hard it is to change people's behavior, it's like, wow, half of them are kept. That's pretty amazing. And that shows you one of the power of the temporal landmark. And so on these fresh start dates, we're more likely to start a change in behavior. And again, if you're more likely to start a change in behavior, you're more likely to accomplish it. So if you want to start a diet, you're better off doing it on a Monday rather than on a Thursday. You're better off doing it on the 1st of May rather than the 14th of May. You're better off doing it on the day after your birthday rather than 3 days before your birthday.
Very interesting. And what about end dates?
Endings are ridiculous. Endings are so interesting. Endings have multiple effects on our behavior. But one of the things that endings do is they help us energize and they all seem to trigger us to pursue meaning. And one of the best examples of that is the research that you just cited, Dimitri, on marathons. If you look at the age at which people run their first marathon, right? It's not marathon running in general. It's the age at which people run their first marathon. People are more likely to run the first marathon. The age at which people are most likely to run their first marathon is age 29. Hmm. Why? Because you're about to be 30. Again, purely arbitrary. But what we know from this research, this is Adam Alter at NYU, Hal Hirschfield at UCLA, is that 29-year-olds are twice as likely to run a first marathon as 28-year-olds. 29-year-olds are twice as likely to run a first marathon as 30-year-olds. Why? They're hitting the end of something. Even something, as you say very well, as arbitrary as the end of a decade. basically made up. Endings help us energize. And so you look at 49-year-olds. 49-year-olds are three times as likely to run a first marathon as 50-year-olds. There's something about hitting those kinds of landmarks that changes our behavior.
I think there's also something interesting about the way in which we use time and these artificial landmarks in order to structure experience over time. And I think there's an example also in your book. You refer to it as pre-mortems, which is basically creating a, if I understand correctly, theorizing about what if something died, what killed it.
Yes. You know?
So if I were to invest in this company that I think is really promising, but if it doesn't turn out well, what caused that? It's sort of a hypothetical scenario that you create in your head in order to help you solve problems. And that's based on the notion of time.
Absolutely. This is an idea from Gary Klein called pre-mortem. And as you say, if you think about what a post-mortem is the body dies, what causes death? Pre-mortem is basically doing that as a hypothetical, as you suggest, which is taking a project and let's say you're thinking about investing in a company, all right? So you go, you do a pre-mortem and say, let's go 2 years from now and this company is a total bust. What went wrong? They didn't have proper financing. They hired the wrong people, whatever you think that those were. And then that pre-mortem says, okay, guys, we're not going to do these kinds of things. We know what's going to cause our demise 2 years from now. Let's work very hard to make sure that we don't fall down those traps.
Mm. And in order to do that, you have to have some sense of time. I mean, that's
sure.
the interesting
The whole
thing.
Point is that you're moving
right.
forward in time.
Right. Even though you're not.
Moving your mind into the future.
Right.
And again, post-mortem is backward-looking. Gary Klein's pre-mortem is prospective,
right.
not
It's very interesting. This is the first time we've ever done a show about the biology of time or the psychological dimensions of time, but we've obviously done shows on the physical nature of time and its relativity. And it's interesting when you look at those scientific findings of physics and empirical and theoretical physics, and you look at what we're describing today, which is that we're really, this is a further point to make about the extent to which time is an artificial construct that serves us. In a sense. Sure, we age, we die. You end your book, the last couple of chapters deal with not synchronicity, maybe, perhaps that's a word, but basically the timing
it's a,
of groups.
It's a police album.
Oh,
yeah.
Was that a police album?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
What does synchronicity mean? Doesn't it mean like when things just sort of happen and you can't explain them?
Yeah, synchronicity means sort of like kismet, fate, serendipity a little bit, but synchronization is something
right,
different.
Synchronization.
Synchronization is something different. Synchronization is when groups of people move together, act together in time.
Right. So it's basically the timing of groups or the science
exactly.
of time in groups.
And
there's this incredible
precisely.
Story you lay out about this workers in India that I did not know about this. And I think it's one of those things where you could easily overlook it if you sort of, because it's at the end of the book and if you're trying to get through it or whatever, you could easily overlook it and you should not. And I suggest to everyone they should go online and look and read and watch stuff about this because it's fascinating. Talk to our audience about, how do they pronounce them? Dabwalas?
Dabwalas, yeah.
Dabwalas. Tell our audience about this incredible phenomenon in India and what it says about timing in groups.
Okay, so we got to take three steps back and talk about the upper middle class Indian culture. So a lot of people who work in offices in a place like Mumbai, they don't want to go out to lunch. So they don't want to go out to, I mean, we're here on 7th Avenue. They don't want to walk down to Applebee's or
this is not a great place to get
Starbucks
food,
or
that,
wherever
right,
to get their lunch. They want to have home-cooked, proper lunch. The problem is they leave for work at 7 o'clock in the morning, so you're not going to get up at 5 to make your home-cooked, proper lunch. Okay. However, India also has upper middle class people often have cooks, and you also have multi-generational households. And so what will often happen in some of these households is that the person who is the cook for this middle-class family, or typically the grandma in this multi-generational household, will actually prepare a really good lunch for the person working in the office all those ways away. You know, dal, chapatis, vegetables, like good, really good food. And they will put them in these things called tiffins, which are these metal containers, and put together like a pretty darn good lunch, home-cooked lunch. The problem is that the lunch is in suburban Mumbai and the workers in downtown Mumbai. They're 20 miles away.
And 20 miles through traffic. Crazy city.
Insane city.
Right.
How do you get it from the apartment to the office? Enter these guys at Dabwalas. They go around every single day, or 6 days a week, pick up the lunches, deliver them to the desks of the loved ones of these people who've cooked their lunch. They do this every single day, 6 days a week, every day of the year, with an accuracy that rivals FedEx and UPS. FedEx and UPS have gone out to study them, how they were able to do this. They do this with no technology. They don't have GPS, so it's not like the people at the desk, like an Uber, like, oh, hey, where's my lunch going, you know? They do this without GPS, without UPC codes, without any technology at all.
But the average guy delivers 40 lunches in an hour, right? Isn't that right? Because it's 5,000 workers delivering 200,000 lunches within a time of about an hour.
Yeah.
It's like from when the food is made to when
although
it gets...
Although they're picking them up earlier in the day.
Okay, how much earlier are they picking them
up? Well, I mean, I went on rounds with one of the Dabbawalas, Ahilo Adav, and so we started picking up lunches around 9:30 or so.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. So first of all, you have to understand Mumbai. Mumbai is out of control, all right? Mumbai makes Manhattan look mellow and like low density.
How many million people are in Mumbai?
If you talk about greater Mumbai, it's probably 19 million, give or take. But it's on a
tiny amount. And there's obviously not the infrastructure is not there for it.
No.
Yeah.
And so what they have to do is they have to take these double walls, they have to take these trains. The trains are really important in linking quote unquote suburban Mumbai to downtown Mumbai. And these trains, so these guys gather all these lunches, they get into the luggage compartment of these trains. They ride the trains down. They have this elaborate coding system where they write certain codes on each lunch. They take them off their back. They redistribute them. They put them on bicycles, on other guys' backs, and they deliver them every single day.
Remarkable.
I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And they have
crazy.
A whole system, and you talk about that in the book and about the uniform, the importance of uniformity in terms of their clothing, in terms of the encoding of the actual lunch boxes and how they do that in order to get efficiency. You know, there's something else that you talk about, which I found even more interesting than this story, which is very interesting. And that had to do with, again, synchronization in groups with respect to sports. And it's something that I alluded to when we started this episode, because we did an episode with the founder of the sports column for The Wall Street Journal, who also wrote a book called Captain Class.
Mm-hmm.
And
Sam Walker, great book.
And so Sam was, so you read it. Okay, so you know everything about that. That was kind of what you were talking about in this book, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, it reminded me of Tim Duncan. It reminded me of Tim Duncan going around touching his teammates.
Good.
And explain that. I think it's interesting because it's intuitive in many ways. And I should also say, you mentioned the same thing about singing in choirs. And I actually found it very therapeutic after a breakup some years ago, singing. And there was one day a week we would sing with other students as well. And I think that's very also interesting. Hmm. Talk to us about that, these sort of intangible elements of synchronization and how they are something that, in a sense, nurtures our health and other things as well.
Yeah. So on the Tim Duncan phenomenon, the touching, there's actually a really nice piece of research about this showing that in NBA teams, what they did is they had people watch videos of the first few games of a season for every team in the NBA. And they just had the people watching them just write down the touches, not like touches of the ball, but like touches of each other. High fives, low fives, fist bumps, chest bumps, whatever. And they found that the more the team touched, that correlated with the team doing well later in the season. So there is this sense of belonging that is necessary for group synchronization. And we foster belonging with our dress, with the codes that we use, whether they're spoken codes, inside jokes. Belonging ends up being, and belonging cues end up being very important for how teams and groups cohere. And I think in Sam's book, one of the interesting things is that when he talks about these captains of these teams, what's so interesting is that the best captains are very rarely the best players.
Mm-hmm.
But what they're very good at is actually sending out all these belonging cues to everyone, saying, hey, you all belong here. You all belong here. So that's that. So on the choirs, the research on choral singing is out of control.
Hmm.
It's ridiculous. Choral singing is basically as good for you as physical exercise. Not singing, singing in a group.
Mm-hmm. Synchronizing with other people.
Exactly. And even to the point where you have choirs, and there's a lot of research on this, you have people who sing in choirs, if you monitor their heartbeats start basically beating in sync when they're singing together. You have even some interesting research in the last, literally in the last 3 or 4 months on neural synchrony, which is basically when people hold hands, people who love each other hold hands, their brain waves are actually working in sync. But with choral singing increases pain thresholds, it improves your immunoglobulin levels, it's a prophylactic against depression. It's really just incredible how good choral singing is for you.
I'll say one more thing. You know, before I came here today to do this interview, I was at my office and a former colleague of mine, actually, who used to be the news director where I used to have my old television show, she's now in this office. It's actually a WeWork. We share a WeWork office space. So we're reunited for the first time in years. And I was watching her going around her teammates and going to different people saying, how are you? Can I get you something? Or this and that. And I thought about, again, what you wrote about in this book, but I thought about it from the time standpoint, because there is a sense in which those types of people, like, you know, Sam, some of the people in Sam's book will call them glue guys or glue people, right? The people that glue the team. Because they're going and they're physically touching and they're speaking and they're creating a sense of common space and time, but really time, because you can be in different spaces, right? You don't have to be in the same place, but you know there's one person that's contacting you with that person. Right. So anyway, I think it's really interesting, and I think that particular part at the end is something that people could easily miss because it gets to the end of the book, but I would suggest that they definitely read it. My last question for you, Daniel, is, now you've written this book, and I do highly recommend people read it. I think it's, first of all, it's short. It's not a difficult read, so it's something that anyone could do. But you finished this. You have an idea of what you want to write next? And I hope that's an appropriate question to ask. And also, what are some of the most interesting findings that you're aware of in the behavioral sciences that you think are interesting that maybe you could share with us here?
Yeah, so what book is next? I have no idea, truly. I don't mind you asking.
It's like asking you, when are you going to get married, Daniel? When are you going to have kids, Daniel?
Yeah.
When are you going to write your next book, Daniel?
I truly have no idea.
Well,
a whole bunch of different things percolating. There are always ideas percolating, but I have no idea. Because here's the thing. I mean, you mentioned getting married. Writing a book is like getting married.
Yeah.
All right? It's not like, you know, writing an article is like going out on a few dates. All right? That's cool. You write an article about anything. But writing a book is...
You also don't want to disappoint your editor.
...is a giant pain in the neck. I mean, a lot of people write crappy books. That's easy to write a crappy book. But if you want to write a good book, it takes massive amounts of time, massive amounts of effort. It's really, really hard. I've written 6 of them. They never gets easier.
And I think also my experience with this is you could take a long time writing the book to realize this is not the book you wanted to write, or this is not a book you want to write.
Bingo. And my advice to writers out there, don't do that. This is why I write a proposal, a lengthy proposal, before I write a book, because, you know, like maybe 20, 30, even 40 pages long. Because if you try to get, you say, hey, what's this book about? Who's going to buy it? Why is it cool? And if you take 30 pages to explain it, and I've done this before, I get to writing it, even finishing the 30 pages or partway through the 30 pages and say, oh my, this is not a book, or this is not a book I want to write. And I'd like to know that now in the proposal stage rather than after I've signed a contract and have a deadline to write a book that I don't want to write.
Daniel, I really appreciate you coming on the show. It was great meeting you.
Thank you, Dimitri. Appreciate it.
And that was my episode with Daniel Pink. I want to thank Daniel for being on the program. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nicolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod, or send me an email at dk@hiddenforces.io. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.